Muy bien. So, I guess we're back on track. Welcome to all of those brave warriors that have made their way to this crazy hour, to this show here. Okay, good. So, yesterday we talked about graph clustering, or we started to talk about graph clustering, and the goal was to come up with an alternative model for groups that in some sense do make sense sociologically, okay? And in contrast to these mostly local prototypes that we talked about before, cliques, plexus, and stuff, now we're in the realm of, graph clustering, okay? And we started by saying that all of our measures that we are going to use in order to formalize our clustering paradigm are constructed like that. So it's basically the sum of two terms. And the first term F measures the intra-cluster density. So how well is the cluster connected, kept together, is dense, factor or the term G measures the intra-cluster sparseness or decoherence or how far the clusters are separated. And all these terms, sparseness, density, coherence, decoherence, are informal terms because this objective function is intended to capture or formalize our intuition about density, compactness, sparseness, and so on. It may use, however, the respective terms from graph theory and so on, but in essence, this is about modeling, right? And modeling is certainly at the key of social computing and social gaming. You need to create appropriate models that model what you want them to model. Okay. And that's why we're having a great degree of freedom here and lots of variance for these functions. And our first real example was conductance. And we said, okay, basically conductance is about cuts. So we want to cut the number, set of vertices or nodes into two halves, okay, and want to see whether the cut goes across many thick or high-weighted edges or not, okay? So the conductance of such a cut is basically proportional to the weights that go across the cut, and this makes clear that the smaller such a conductance value of a cut is, the more bottlenecky the respective underlying graph is, in a sense, or the more bottlenecky the cut actually is. And then we made ourselves this rather schematic drawing. So if that's the graph, right, and we make a cut, that's that. And the more high-weighted edges go across that cut, the less, the higher the conductance. Okay, so the higher is this graph connected in a sense, right? And the extreme case is if we have like two halves, and that's just a schematic drawing where we have only very few and very thin edges, and then we can make a cut where the weight of the edges that goes across the cut is comparatively small. So in this case, we might call the graph, bottlenecky, and the cut having this property as well, right? And then we said, okay, good. How can we construct a respective quality measure? And as always, what we want later on is to optimize, maximize the quality measure. Yes? So the question is, how do I know what the weight of the respective link is? And the answer is, so that's a given quantity, right? Assume, for example, that you're having a social network, right? In Facebook, for example, and other social networking platforms, these social ties are not weighted, right? So you're having the handshake and then you're friend with somebody and that's that. Every edge has a weight of one. Now, there is countless ways to directly or indirectly assess social tie strengths, for example. And that's just one example of how you could attribute weights to a social edge. For example, if you have access to the messages that are exchanged between two people, right? What you can do is simply to count them. Count the total number of messages and set this into proportion to, let's say, the average amount of messages exchanged in that medium. That's one thing. But you can be more fine-grained and say, okay, what I want is not only that many messages are exchanged, but also if I only have an undirected edge, I also want them to be, like more or less even. If you send me 1,000 messages and I send you one, we cannot assume that the tie strength between us is very high. Yeah. So it's better if you send me 1,000 and I send you 1,000 back. And other things concern, for example, the timing. Yeah. If I answer you immediately and you answer me immediately, then we can more or less also conclude that the tie strength is in a sense high. It doesn't need to be an emotional tie necessarily. It could also be that we're working closely together or something. But it's necessary, and obviously there is things going on that edge, whatever. And there's countless ways to do that, and there was a seminal paper by two authors, Gilbert and Kahelios, at CHI several years ago, and they kind of formalized that, right? And you have other chances to come up with weights, but this is a given thing for the moment. We assume that we have a weighted graph, right? Good. And the first chance to construct such a quality measure that we are going to optimize in order to come up with a good graph clustering is that we use the conductance in that way, right? So we leave out G and say that F, the measure for intra-cluster coherence, is just the minimum of the conductance of the partition elements or the clusters. Okay. So remember that a clustering is a partition of the set of nodes into several of these CIs, right? And then I investigate all the CIs in turn. Yeah. And I take the minimum of the conductance of each CI. Now, if one of them should turn out to have a small conductance, what does that mean? Okay, good. So you have the set of nodes, you partitioned them, and if one of these clusters has a small conductance, then due to the minimum function, F is also small. Yeah. What does that mean? That means that one of these CIs looks like this, and thus should be cut, right? And if the conductance is high for all of the CIs, then they're all, in a sense, internally okay. Yeah. So internally, they look more like this than like this, all of them. And that's okay. So we don't need to cut them any further. Yeah. So in other words, if F is small, it means that we have some CI, one or more, that needs cutting. Okay? And that means that the original clustering was not of a good quality because it neglected the fact that one or more of them needs cutting. Okay? And if F is high, it means that the clustering is in a sense okay, at least with respect to intra-cluster coherence, right? Because the conductance of all of them is high. So, good. That's what we find, and that's what we can use, okay? And as you might have guessed already, if there is a measure where G is zero and F is something, we can as well construct something for the intercluster decoherence. That's what G measures. And we can do that by 1 minus the maximum of cut and the conductance of the cut that is induced by taking one of the CIs and regarding the rest of the nodes. Okay, so here we're regarding the conductance of the induced graphs of the CIs, right? And we know that the conductance of a graph is the minimum over all possible cuts. Yeah? So if you have a graph, you're investigating all the cuts that are possible and take the minimum, and then that's the conductance of a graph. Okay? Now, originally, you remember, the conductance was formulated as the conductance of a cut. So it's still possible to use that. And here for the G measure, we actually do. So we're taking all the CIs. Yeah? So let's assume this is our original large graph. Yeah? And then let's say we're making our clustering introduces 4 partitions. Yeah? C1, C2, C3, and C4. Right? And each of them induces a subgraph that we can investigate. Yeah? So we can compute the conductance. We can do a lot of things. Okay. Now, what we can also do is to regard the conductance of the cut, for example, for C1. Yeah. So we can cut the original graph here. So C1 is 1/2, and all the rest here is the other half. Okay. And we're doing this for all the CIs. And, okay, and then we're taking the maximum. So, what does that mean? So, if this maximum is large, that means that we have at least, that we have at least one of them that is too fine. Okay? So, let's assume C1 and C2 should rather be united. Yeah? So it's better in terms of our intercluster decoherence intuition to have that as a new C1. Yeah, and so these we can rename that way. Yeah, if that's the better actual clustering, then we see that if we induced our original one, yeah, this one was too fine, and it means that we can really have a value here among these maxes, yeah, that is high. So 1 minus this max would then give a low value for G. And G, thus, is a direct proportional measure for the intercluster decoherence. That's what we want to maximize, okay? It's a bit of an indirect thinking. So if you would not understand that right now, just make yourself clear what the definitions are, and you'll see that this is actually a good modeling for that. Okay, and what you can do is use F and G at the same time, but you can also use them separately, in essence, right? And that's all the thinking that we need in that chapter, so we can construct these quality measures reasonably modeling our intuition about clustering. And if we do so, we can numerically optimize them later on. We'll see how this is done in a second. Okay? Good. So that was that on conductance-based quality measures. Now, a bit more of a simple, a slightly simpler idea is the idea of performance. And performance is just another quality measure. And the idea is that, in a sense, you can have correctly classified edges and incorrectly classified edges, okay? And we assume that an edge in the graph is correctly classified by the clustering if it is either within such a cluster, yeah, if two nodes, I should say, two nodes are correctly classified if they're in the same cluster, in this case here, and if they're connected by an edge, yeah, so that's okay. If they're in this in different clusters and they're connected by an edge, we would assume that they're not correctly classified, okay? Because what we want, obviously, is to maximize the coherence within a cluster and to maximize the decoherence, right? So a pair is correctly classified by the clustering, in a sense, if it's in the same cluster and connected by an edge, yeah? Or if it's not in the same cluster and not connected by an edge, right? So that's not correctly classified, and these are correctly classified by the clustering, okay? And you can count them separately. And, yeah, well, F would then just be the sum of all the edges within the clusters, and G would be counting all the pairs that are in different clusters but not connected by an edge, okay? And once again, we're using this Iverson notation, meaning that everything in square brackets is supposed to be an expression of first-order logic, which can be assigned a truth value. And if this expression is true, then the value of the Iverson bracket is numerically 1, okay? So that's how you can count with the Iverson brackets, just by summing. Okay, that's precisely what we do here. Now, that seems rather simple, and you can, in some sense, optimize F and G or F plus G. The question is, we somehow neglected the edges, the weights, okay? And we will see how we do this in a second. One notational thing here, instead of writing this condition here as an Iverson bracket, yeah, so one of the nodes must be in one clustering, one the other node in the other clustering, and the indices must not be equal. And a more convenient notation that you might know from other subjects or even from computer science is this Kronecker symbol, okay? So we could denote the Iverson bracket as delta of Ci and Cj, with I unequal to J. That's already implicitly contained, yeah? Because this Kronecker delta is 1 if its arguments are equal and 0 otherwise. That's the precise definition. Other notations could be that, just leaving out the C's and just regarding the indices, okay? Now, that's a real useful symbol, for example, when you do matrix calculus in machine learning, for example, when you do derivations, yeah, and then need to do, for example, like calculations. One example, let's say we have a matrix Mij, and this is multiplied by some feature vector, and you'd have an expression that looks like this, yeah? And if you compute the derivation with respect to xa, yeah, for example, of this expression, what you get is that sum over j, mij, and now m is just a constant, that's just a matrix element, and x, the derivation of x with respect to x is either 1, yeah, and that's in case that a and j are equal, And if A and J are not equal, then this X, this particular X, would just be regarded as a constant, right? So what we write here is nothing but delta AJ. And then you can, because that's the definition of that Kronecker symbol, 1 if A and J are equal, 0 otherwise. And then we can execute this summation because we know that most of these things are 0 and the result would be MIA. Yeah? And that's just useful for matrix calculus if you need to do that in some sense. Yeah? That's a thing that's really very frequently used in math and physics, for example. Yeah? But back to this idea of performance. Okay. Good. One thing that we must note is that if we want to use our intuition about performance, the downside is that computing the maximum of F plus G in that fashion here is unfortunately NP hard. So, and furthermore, so the original term for the quality measure had this F plus G maximized in the denominator as a normalizing constant. So that's certainly not useful because computing the maximum of F plus G is already solving the clustering problem. Okay. So what we can use, for example, is V times V minus 1 or half times V times V minus 1, because that's just the number of pairs, okay? We can have correctly classified pairs. That's just a subset, okay? Good. So this measure, although it's NP-hard, we for small graphs, we could still try it, or we could try to approximate this. However, if you do so, and especially when the graph is sparse, for example, as in planar graphs, then the tendency of performance is to deliver many small clusters, at least in the optimum. So if you have this gray graph here, so this is the result of the clustering that gives us the best value of performance. And as you can see from the structure of the graph, this here or this might be other intuitive solutions to the clustering problem with larger clusters. Yeah, and that's a typical example for modeling, right? You have your intuition about intra-cluster coherence and inter-cluster decoherence and so on and so on. And you chose to actually implement this with performance. And the result is that you get small clusters. If your intuition was rather to get larger clusters, the consequence is that you need to choose another objective function. Yeah. Because this objective function, although it's a model for your original intuition, this might not be a precise model of your precise intuition. And that's always what you have. So we cannot speak of, that some of these functions are, more correct than others. It's just that they model different aspects. And that's what you need to consider. And that's why we're talking about so many variants, yeah, because some variants make sense in some contexts and some others in others. Okay. Good. Now, what we left out was the weights. Okay. We just counted edges that are correctly or incorrectly classified. Now, how do we take weights into account? So for F, it's easy. Yeah. I mean, F counted the correctly classified edges within clusters. And it's easy, just sum up their weights, okay? Instead of saying just there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we can say we sum up the weights. Now, for G, it's less intuitive because G counts the edges that are absent, that are not there, okay? And edges that are not there can naturally not have weights, okay? And what G in original fashion completely neglected was these edges that go across cluster borders, but that that are not counted and they're not accounted for in any way, right? So if this is a high weight edge, it should in a sense negatively contribute to G, but this is not in the original formula, okay? So in order to cope with this problem, what we can say is, cool, I don't know about the weight of edges that are not there, but what I can say is that if I have a maximum weight, and if I'm, let's say if I normalize all my weights between to between 0 and 1, then the maximum weight would be m equal to 1, and all these weights would be between 0 and 1. So what I can do is I can multiply this counting here with the maximum weight. Okay, so that's a very pessimistic way of dealing with things. Okay, now, but still, these edges that are actually there and cut across the boundaries of the clustering should be accounted for negatively as well. And how can you do that? In that fashion, okay? So you have your original G, which kind of just counts. And then you have this term here, which depends on the weights. And what you do is you would have this expression. So these are all the edges that kind of cut across, or this would be the most negative thing that could happen. Okay, so this m is the maximum weight, and this just counts the number of edges that go across. And if you subtract the actual weights, yeah, I mean this is what results. Okay, and the intuition is that if the weight, so let's just repeat what EC bar is that we had in the beginning here in our notations. So EC bar is the set of intercluster edges. So the edges that actually go across here, and the weights are just summed up weight of these edges, right? Good. And so this is the set of all the edges that cut across borders. And we assume we know that number, yeah, in that case. And if we compute just that difference, yeah, if that difference is small, then we're having a good clustering, right? Because the actual weights here are small. And this is the maximum that could potentially occur, and what we want is that G prime is large as an index if it has few of these guys here with high weights. Yeah, so that's just what's formalized with this difference. Yeah, and the overall index that you could then have is the weighted F plus G plus some parameter times this correction here. Okay, so that's in a way an additional way to also account for these actual negatively acting edges. Okay? Good. Good. So that's just a way to do that with the help of performance. Okay? If you happen to have some density measure on your graph or on graphs in general, what you can do is you can compute this density of the induced subgraphs of the respective clusters, right? And this density would then be a variant of F, right? If the density of the clusterings is high, okay, then we say, okay, they obviously have a high intra-cluster coherence, okay? And that's just a graph theoretic density measure, and there are a lot of them around. And you can be pessimistic by taking the minimum of all of them, right? You can be optimistic by taking the maximum. And you can be, well-tempered or reasonable if you take the average, okay? And that's just other ideas how to come up with an F-like type of objective function, okay? Good. Now, you might say, well, at the point, so obviously you can formalize the clustering paradigm in many ways with many types of those functions. So but how do we actually do the optimization? And mathematics offers us a huge arsenal of theories, or one theory, in terms of how to optimize objective functions. Yes, that's the mathematical field of optimization. Okay, and one of the simplest algorithms or ways to deal with that is greedy optimization. So you might have come across greedy optimization already. And what greedy optimization does is to greedily, in the true sense of the word, follow the steepest ascent or steepest descent. Okay, so let's assume you had an objective function that operates on the plane, right, on the R2, and that would look like that. So we have, here we have our plane, so x1 and x2, and that's the value of the objective function, let's call it whatever, f, right? And so you might have something that looks like this, yeah? So like a surface, in a sense, that looks like this, and that lives on that plane, okay? And what you do is you start at some point, like here, for example, and if you want to maximize f, what you do is you compute the gradient, yeah, which is like a direction here in the two plane, and you follow that gradient ever more and to a new point, and you would calculate the new gradient and so on until you reach a local optimum where the gradient actually vanishes, as you know, since gradient of f is zero in these local optima. Yeah, so there is no direction of ascent to follow anymore. And so that's a nice algorithm in a sense, but it's also a stupid algorithm because you would only be able to locate local optima. Yeah? And the same is true if you want to minimize things. Well, okay, if you want to minimize things, then you start again somewhere and you follow the gradient down until you reach some local minimum. Let's say it lies here. Yeah. And in the local minimum, also the gradient vanishes. So there's no direction to go to. Now, that's greedy approaches. And there are a lot of variants of these greedy approaches. Patrick van der Smacht, for example, explained in the machine learning lecture a lot of variants to locally deal with these gradients and also to incorporate second-order information into these schemas. Yeah? Second-order information would be to regard the Hessian matrix and to deal with that in intelligent ways. Okay, don't need to compute the actual matrices. You can do better by more intelligent techniques. Now, more formally, if let's say we want to do greedy minimization, which in our case we won't. We need maximization, but just for the sake of being to conform with the actual background reading. If you want to do greedy minimization, so you start with some feasible solution to a problem. In our case, for the clustering, that means we're having a clustering, and this clustering has some particular value of f plus g. Okay? Now, while you're able to construct new solutions, do the following. So a new solution that's feasible is in some sense in the neighborhood of the current solution, right? So speaking of, we start with L0 in our 2D function case. And so the neighborhood of our current solution are all the points that are in a sense in that local neighborhood here, okay? And for all of them, only those would be taken into account that have a lower cost function than the current solution. Yeah. So in our case, we did maximization. Yeah. So for maximization, we would have to replace this smaller with a larger sign. Yeah. So only those that would account for a higher value of the objective function. In our case, it was F. Here it's called C. Doesn't matter, right? Only those that have a higher value would be feasible solutions. Yeah. It must be in the neighborhood and must deliver a higher value. Yeah. And if just choose one of them and, or in this case, the one that has the lowest cost, right? And then this is your current new solution. And then you iterate until this neighborhood becomes zero. Yeah. In our case, we iterate this until we arrive here. And here, there are no more solutions that have a lower cost. Yeah. Or in this, yeah, or a higher cost in our maximization case. Yeah. So that's what greedy optimization looks like. Yeah. And as I said, for greedy maximization, you must replace this smaller than with the larger and the argmin with an argmax. Okay. And these cost functions are precisely our cluster quality measures, either F or F plus G or G alone, whatever you want. Okay. Now, I'm sorry. You might ask yourself, good, okay, I see the point, got it. For this analysis example here with the surfaces, it's clear, but what about clusterings? In the end, what we have in our case here as points in the plane are clusterings, and we can change clusterings to other clusterings. The question is, how do we do that? So how do we construct, if you're given a clustering L, yeah, or if you're given a clustering Li, I should say, what are those L that are in the neighborhood of that clustering? Yeah. And a simple solution is, if you're having a clustering, you can merge clusters or you can split clusters. Yeah. So then we would have the clusters that are in the neighborhood are a coarsening or are a refinement of your current clustering. And that's a simple way to produce these neighborhoods. Okay. And what results is a whole hierarchy of these clusterings, and a visualization of that hierarchy is called dendrogram. Okay. Dendrogram in essence is a tree, and the node of that tree is the one clustering. So this is the clustering where you have only one cluster and put everything inside. That's one of our trivial clusterings. And the leaves are singletons. Yeah. So in each of these leaves, there's a, where they correspond to a cluster where with only one member. Yeah. And at each level corresponds to a clustering. For example, if you have the lowest level consisting only of the leaves, then you have the singleton clustering. Yeah. So you have 10 nodes in the graph, and then you have 10 clusters with one node each. Yeah, that's a clustering. And the one clustering is also a clustering, and all the ones in between are also clusterings. Yeah. For example, here in that case, you're having 5 nodes. Yeah. And if you cut the dendrogram at this level, at that green level, what you have is basically 4 clusters. 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, you could also cut it here, then you'd have 3. You can cut it here, you'd have 2, and so on, right? So this tree represents you the clustering structure of your graph at all levels of abstraction, in a sense, yeah? Ranging from the most trivial singleton-based clustering to ever more coarse clusterings until you reach the one clustering. Okay. And that's just a second dendrogram. Yeah, and you, the clustering algorithm that you choose delivers you different dendrograms. And naturally, they should be similar in a sense, because all the clustering approaches would formalize and should correctly formalize your clustering intuition, intra-cluster coherence and intercluster decoherence. However, as we've seen, for example, with performance, all the different approaches produce slightly different results. Yeah. And one example that we can use in order as an example for this technique, for this greedy technique is, single link and complete link clustering. And we'll see what this is. Okay. So, as you can imagine from here, if you want to construct neighborhoods of a given solution, of a given clustering, you can either merge or split, right? And in terms of dendrograms, that means you can start from the one clustering and split it until you reach the singletons. Or you can start from the singletons and merge until you reach the one cluster, right? Bottom up and top down. And these things where you merge, these algorithms are called agglomerative clusterings, and special examples are linkage algorithms. And the other ones that are splitting-based are divisive clustering algorithms. Okay. Now, linkage is the one we start with. So here we start from the singletons and go up until we reach the one clustering via merging clusters. So we're given a weighted graph and some initial clustering, in our case, the singleton clustering. And then we use criteria to know which of the clusters in our current clustering to merge. Okay. That's just what you do. You have your clustering, let's say with five clusters, and then you check each of the pairs, which are nice to unify or to merge, right? And this notion of niceness is formalized with the help of, again, objective functions. And the objective functions can be a global quality measure as the ones that we had, or it could be a local measure that just takes two clusterings and says for each pair of these clusterings what is the value of merging them. Yeah, so that's why you take one clustering out of the power set of V, a cluster out of the power set of V, another cluster out of the power set of V, and then this local cost function formalizes how good it would be to merge them. Yeah? Good. And we have two choices. We can merge those two clusters for the next step that yield the maximum global cost. Yeah? Or the minimum global cost, whatever you formalize it like. Or you can merge the two clusters with a minimum local merging cost. Yeah. So in a sense, we should keep things apart, right? The objective functions, the cluster quality measures, are constructed in a way that you want to maximize them, right? So a higher quality measure means a better clustering, yeah? And this here are cost functions, okay? And cost is something that you want to minimize, yeah? But in a sense, they're both formalizing the same thing, just in another way, yeah? Good. So what we want here is we want minimum global or local cost, okay? Now, linkage is instantiated in two versions, and these two versions are called single linkage and complete linkage. We'll I think we'll understand the terms in a second. And both are just variants for the cost function. Yeah. And single linkage takes the minimal distance of two nodes in each of the candidate clusters to be merged or not, and computes the minimum of this distance. And complete linkage, it computes the maximum. So how do we interpret that? So let's make a quick drawing. So, okay, back to, that's our original graph. Let's assume we have a clustering with four clusters, okay? Now, we're asked to merge either just two of them. So these, or these, or this, or this. So which of these should we merge? And the criterion is this local cost, okay? So let's do single linkage first, yeah? So single linkage checks for any pair. Let's say we want to test whether we should merge these two, okay? So for any pair here in these clusters, it checks the path distance and its length in the graph, okay? And if that distance is large, well, okay, that's one thing. But what single linkage wants is to take the minimal distance that it finds, okay? Let's assume that this is the case, yeah? And all the others have a higher, larger path length between them. So single link says, okay, I want to merge that where this local cost is minimal, and the local cost is the minimum of all the path length pairs that I find here in these clusters. In that sense, single linkage is extremely optimistic. Yeah, it says, if only there is a pair of nodes that has a small path distance, then I'm satisfied and I say, well, these two clusters are candidates for merging, right? Complete link is extremely pessimistic because it says, okay, my criterion for merging clusters is that I seek the pair that has the largest distance, yeah? And then I say, this is my criterion whether I should merge them, okay? So complete linkage is pessimistic and single linkage is optimistic. Now you can ask yourself, isn't there a reasonable way in between? And the answer is yes, sure, and that's called average linkage, right? So you can, instead of taking either the max or the min, you can take the average. And for many cases, this delivers also very good results. Now, what's the actual way to proceed? Now, going back here to our case. So we know now we can have a clustering, and we know how we can construct clusterings in the neighborhood by merging, for example. And that was our local cost function that allowed us to decide whether we or which of those we want to merge. And merging would then yield, for example, such a dendrogram. Yeah, that's the stuff we're after at the moment. So how does that work algorithmically? And I just denoted that for you. I know it's not a good slide, but you can read through that at home, and I will do an example instead. Instead of going through that algorithm, I'm going to do an example, okay? And that's the example. Assume that your graph is defined via that weight matrix here above, okay? So we're having five nodes, V0 to V4, and each entry in that matrix is supposed to denote the weight of that respective edge. Okay, good. So far, so good. So we know this is the weighted adjacency matrix of our graph. What do we do now? So what we do now is we can construct, or we should construct, so-called threshold graphs. Okay, so there is no picture of that graph at all, right? So this is not the actual graph down here, but these are, series of threshold graphs. And the way you do them is you draw your nodes and then consecutively lower your threshold weight, okay? And you start to draw edges once your threshold is below the respective weight in the adjacency matrix. So you start with a weight of infinity, yeah? So no edge in this graph actually has a weight of infinity except here on the diagonal. So in a sense, you can start drawing the nodes themselves, okay? Now you're going down, yeah? 1,500, 250, and you'll see from these weights that none of them is above that threshold, yeah? And you keep lowering and lowering and lowering until you reach 9, right? And if you reach 9, you see in the weight graph, the edge between V2 and V1 has a weight of 9. So here I can draw it from 1 to 2. And you keep on lowering. Now you have a threshold of 8, and there you can add the edge from V3 to V0, yeah, because that has a weight of 8, yeah, symmetric matrix, yeah, and so on and so on. So you keep on lowering the weight and the threshold, and the edges that have weights that are above the current threshold keep on appearing. Yeah. So in a sense, you're having a structure which is covered by water, and you gradually lower the level of the water, and structures keep on appearing out of the sea. Yeah, that's what you do. And you can continue this until you reach zero. If you have zero, then you should have drawn all the edges. Okay. So since here we're having a value of a non-zero value, yeah, or a value, a numeric value on for each entry, what we have in essence is a complete graph in the end, or we have a complete graph that we started with, I should say, here, this one. And this is just, it has just appropriate weights on its edges, yeah? So remember, if I have some nodes, yeah, I can draw something like that. And that's a graph, right? And I can put weights on that, 5, 6, 100, okay? Now, what we said was it makes a difference whether we have a weight, an edge with weight 0 or non-existent edge, yeah? So this edge here just does not exist, and this one exists but has a weight 0, yeah? So that's what we started with. But actually, in a sense, this is equivalent if you would just say, okay, a weight that is absent can be encoded by having a weight of 0, okay? So in this case, we can add weights with 0 here, right? For all of them, okay? And that's one way to encode a weighted graph. So in essence, you'd have a complete graph, but any of the non-existing edges has a weight 0. And that's just what we have here. Yeah. So that's our notion here. So in the end, if we construct our threshold graphs, what we end up with is a complete graph if we have a threshold of 0. Yeah. Just lowering and the edges keep on appearing. Now, going back to single link and complete link. Single link was the one that's optimistic. And it said it wants to merge those clusterings that have the minimum distance of the paths, or the minimum distance of any pair of nodes is the criterion for single link. Whereas complete link takes the maximum. Now, what are clusterings here? So for single link, any connected component of the graph is a cluster. Yeah. So single link starts with singleton clusters as well as complete link does that also. Yeah. So what we have is the respective clusters that are formed by taking clusters with one node each, right? And then if one and two become connected, yeah, or more precisely, if in step T plus one, clusters become connected that have been clusters in T minus one or T, sorry, then for single link, these are merged. Yeah? So the first merging occurs between one and two because that was a cluster before. That itself was also a cluster. In the new iteration here, from here to here, two clusters become connected. Bingo, single link is satisfied. Yeah. And that precisely corresponds to being very optimistic. Yeah. So once clusters become connected, bingo, single link would merge them. Okay. And that precisely corresponds to taking the minimum of the path lengths, in a sense, yeah, if you think it over. Now, going further with single links, so 0 and 3 become connected in the next step, so you would connect them. And then 4 is connected to this 1, 2 cluster. 4 is connected to this 1, 2 cluster. And in that step, 0 becomes connected to that 3, 4 cluster. Yeah, sorry. No, that's not right. This edge comes along. So we had as clusters 1, 2, 4. That's this one. And we had 0, 3. That's this one. And in the step from here to here, this edge appears out of the threshold. And so these two become connected and we're done. Yeah. So single link says, well, now I'm done. That's my dendrogram that I construct. Complete link, as we said, is extremely pessimistic. It regards all the pairs and says, I want to have the maximum length as a criterion whether I should merge or not. And that corresponds to the following rule for complete link. In complete link, you merge clusters if they have been clusters in the previous step and are a complete graph in the following step. So you only accept clusters, graph cliques, I should say, as prototypes, as clusters. Okay. So what does that mean? So complete link. Okay. You'd have these clusters in the infinity threshold graph. Now this is the next step in the G9 threshold graph. Okay. So this is a clique on its own, technically, because it's only one node. Yeah, it's a very simple clique. And this is also a simple clique. And they become a complete graph in that step. So, yeah, complete link says, okay, 1 and 2, I accept. Yeah. Same is true for 0 and 3. Yeah. Because V0, the singleton, has been a clique. This is a clique. And 0 and 3, this simple subgraph here, is also a clique. Okay, good. Complete link is satisfied. And now it continues. So now this edge appears here, but what it does, I mean, it connects cliques. Yeah, this is a clique and this is another simple clique, but the result is not a clique on its own. Yeah, because that's just that graph. So complete link is not satisfied. Yeah. Still, the maximum distance is the criterion here. Yeah. And it continues and continues, still not satisfied. Okay. Now here we have a triangle. Is that something we accept? The answer is yes, we would accept it, but what we had is, was a cluster, and this was a cluster, and V4 was a cluster. But we just cannot introduce this triangle as a new cluster because that's not the result of merging one of a pair of these. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, it would have been a triangle, but it's not merging one of the existing clusters. Damn it. Okay. And we continue. Okay. Now this is another one, another triangle, but also it's not a merging of existing clustering, and so on and so on. And you need to construct way more of these threshold graphs until finally you can accept that you would merge at least this graph here with this graph, or this clique with this four clique. When does that occur? Let's think. Does it occur in that step? No. It occurs in that step, okay? No, even not. No, not here. Here, that's the one where we can do this merging, because now the 0, 3 and the 4 are connected and give a triangle a clique on its own. Yeah. And then you continue constructing the threshold graphs until finally you have the complete graph, and then you can do this last link. Yeah. So single link, totally optimistic, complete link, totally pessimistic. Naturally, average link would somehow mediate between the extremes. Yeah. And that's a simple agglomerative hierarchical clustering algorithm operating on graphs. Yeah, that's what we have. Good. Instead of the weight matrix, we might also use a distance matrix. Yeah, so you know that typically similarities or weights can be constructed from distances like this. Yeah, similarity is 1/1 plus distance, so you might as well compute the one from the other. And in that case, we would have to replace some elements in the algorithm with the respective opposites, so larger with smaller and so on. Okay, good. Okay, that's agglomerative clustering. Yeah, you simply go bottom up and construct the dendrograms. What about splitting-based algorithms? Okay, let's look at them. Obviously, you start top, as you go ahead top down, and you start with the one clustering, and then you continuously split until you reach the trivial clusterings where each cluster has only one node. So now we have several variants. We have a global criterion cost function, that's some variant, or we might have a strictly local one, yeah, like this, or we might have a global one plus a cut function and a local one plus a cut function. So what does that mean, and what's a cut function, for Christ's sake? Okay, good. So a cut function, in a sense, takes a graph and computes the cut that delivers, that's in a sense the optimal cut. Yeah. So you can imagine that if I have a graph, I can do a lot of cuts. Yeah. But there is certainly an optimal cut, an optimal in the sense that it crosses the fewest edges, or the edges with the lowest weights. And that's just what this cut function computes. So why is this of the power set? So this is the graph, and it contains the nodes, and the node set is V. And the power set is the set of all the subsets of V, right? So what we take if we compute a cut is this is a subset of V, or it corresponds to one. And since we know V, if we know the first half, we automatically know the second half. Okay, that's why the cut function just takes the power set of V and maps it to the actual power set of V. Right? Good. Now, why do we have these cut functions? The answer is, merging is in a sense easy because at one moment in time, you only have the clusters that you have. Now, if you want to split, let's say you're in between, you also have clusters. But which of them am I going to split? The answer is, the pair that delivers the smallest cost in either of the four variants. But how do I split it? That's open. Merging is easy. You just throw them together. But if you're to split one of them, then you don't know how to do it. So the cut functions kind of help you in that because they compute the optimal cut. Yeah, good. So in a sense, you can have all the four variants, yeah, and these cut functions introduce something that is semi-local. Yeah, before we had global or local, now we have global and local with these aiding cut functions. Yeah, so this would be strictly global, this would be strictly local, and these are semi-global or semi-local. Okay, good. So then that's the interpretation of these elements here. Okay, good. So here, this is one of the clusters. That's why it's also out of the power set of V. Yeah. Let's assume you have that situation. You have four clusters and you're considering, am I going to split this one or this one or this one or this one? Okay, good. Let's say I choose this one. The question is, how do I cut it? Do I cut it such or such? And the cut function takes this set, which is out of the power set of the whole graph. Yeah. It is a subset and says, okay, I want to suggest this cut. And this cut I want to suggest by stating this is another element of the power set of V that should make up one half of my cut. Okay. And that's how this cut function assists you in splitting. Now, what are cut functions then? Okay. Let's look at some variants. So I said a cut function computes the optimal cut. And how do we know what is optimal? One thing is, a cut is optimal if it minimizes the weights across the cut, yeah, of the edges. Yeah, that's one thing. And you can have that plain version, or you can have that plain version normalized by the respective possible numbers of pairs, or you can normalize it in that fashion. So there are many variants, but in essence, it's always proportional to these weights that cut across, that are cut across. Yeah. And this is just another way to state that. So that's just the minimum of the conductance. Yeah. So if you find a cut that minimizes conductance, this is a good cut in a sense. Yeah. And this is just inverted measure that we might call delta, not to be confused with this Kronecker delta. Yeah, good. This is just to remind you of our definition here. Good. So these are possible cut functions that you might use, and this is an intricate optimization problem. Yeah, you would have for these semi-global versions, for example, you have your global cost function and the cut cost function, and you would have to somehow deal with both of them during optimization. Yeah, good. Now, there is one other idea that I have kind of neglected for the moment. In our problem of constructing one clustering from a given clustering, we said, okay, what we can do is merge or split, coarse or refine, making coarser or refine the clustering. Now, there is another technique, and that's just exchanging elements between the clusters. Yeah. So, for example, I could say, well, let's draw something else. Whoops, different. Let's assume these are my nodes in the graph, and I just list them as a list, okay? And then I say, good, what's a clustering? A clustering is, in a sense, a partition of that set, okay? Good, let's number them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, okay? Now, what we said was we could either merge or, let's say, split. I can split this cluster in two halves, yeah? That's one thing, or I can merge both of them by eradicating this division. Now, but one thing, what we can do is to just exchange elements and say, 3 is now in that cluster, and 2 now is in that cluster, okay? That's just a local operation. What we can also do is we can take out one of them and put it in its own singleton cluster, right? And good. What we can also do, so this operation was this last one, exchanging cluster assignments of two nodes. But what we can also do is just take my 8 and put it here, yeah? Move it. That's the first operation I can also use. And these things can naturally be used in other versions of clustering, for example, that are based on genetic algorithms. Yeah? Genetic algorithms are an optimization technique that operates on a fitness function, and fit for life in the sense of evolution. And the technique is that you would consider solutions for your problem in parallel. Yeah. So let's say we're considering 100 solutions of my original problem. And what genetic algorithms do is they modify the solutions and combine them according to the fitness function. And that's just what happens in our genome during the evolutionary process. Yeah. So you're having fitness functions, like, for example, your reproductive value. Yeah. Let's assume attractiveness in the sense of humans. Yeah. So in humans, attractiveness, for example, is conveyed via the symmetry of your face. Yeah. If you have a completely contorted face, nobody would consider you attractive. Yeah. But why is symmetry a fitness criterion? The answer is because if your face and your body is symmetric, then a potential partner can conclude that your gene expression system works well. Okay. Because the genes are expressed and translated into proteins. If that's done correctly, then a human body would result that's symmetric, proportional, and fulfills all the criteria that we deem attractive. Okay, and the same is true for genetic algorithms. Each of the solutions of your problem has a fitness value, and you do mutations, for example, local exchanges of nodes from the clustering. And what you can also do is to combine whole subsolutions. Yeah. And these have their counterparts in genomes as well. So mutations can be done, for example, cosmic radiation. One of the bases is changed to another base, yeah, in the DNA. Or you can have things where whole sections of the DNA are recombined. Yeah, these are all elements that occur in our evolutionary processes. And the same is true here. And this fitness function we would call a potential. Yeah. And the potential would make use of these shifting operations here, or it could also use compound operations in order to reach the global extremum. Okay. And this is a more advanced technique, but one that also works very well. Yeah. And you can use that potential function also without genetic algorithms. But genetic algorithms would have a fitness function that corresponds to this potential function that you could use here as well. Okay, good. So that was that. So what we had was many variants for objective functions. We investigated greedy optimization as a very simple form of optimizing them in order to get a clustering. And we talked about how this might be included in algorithms. Yeah. And our prototypical examples were single link and complete link. They used merging and splitting. And the last remark was that shifting operations, moving and local modifications can also be used to construct that neighborhood of possible solutions that you might reach from a given solution. Okay, that was all that. Now, as a last element for today's lecture, I want to introduce you to a very popular other graph clustering technique that came about, 2009. We'll look it up. Yeah. And that was proposed by Gervin and Newman. And that's called, the Gervin-Newman method, which is also splitting based. And it uses a clever, criterion function to actually cut the dendrograms. Yeah. Because that's something I kind of neglected. If you compute a dendrogram with the help of splitting or merging, in the end, you must decide at which level to cut it to actually get the right clustering. Yeah. And for that, what you use is, again, cluster validity measures, like the ones we talked about, the quality measures, and you would cut the dendrogram at that point where this quality measure is best. Yeah. We'll see that in a moment. Now, Newman and Gervin, or Gervin and Newman, as I should say, came up with the following idea. Okay. Their critique was that these agglomerative methods, single link and complete link, kind of fail to correctly classify or cluster peripheral nodes in the graph. Yeah. And what they suggested was, we want to do a hierarchical clustering again, but we want to use splitting, yeah, so top down. But splitting should be done in an intelligent way. And what they suggest to use is shortest path or edge betweenness measures. Yeah, we know that betweenness measures are measures of centrality. And the idea is simply, if you start with the one clustering and you want to split, what you can do is you can split one node at a time. And the first node you want to take out is the one with the highest centrality. Yeah. Until at the very end, you would reach the nodes that have very low centralities while you're moving towards the singleton clusters. Yeah. So what you're after is to continuously remove. Yeah. No, you don't remove nodes. That was an error. You want to remove edges. Okay. In a sense. So you continuously remove edges until in the end, when you have removed all the edges, the only thing that's left is the bare vertices, the bare nodes, and no edges. Okay, and this is the singleton clustering. Yeah, and you do this top down, and the first node, the first edge, sorry, that you remove is the one with the highest edge centrality. Okay, sorry, not about the nodes, it's about the edges. Clear. And for that, you can use shortest path between the centrality or what all the other measures that we had. Current, electrical current based, or random walk based centralities, whatever you want. Yeah. And this is an iterative process. Yeah. So you remove the edge with the highest centrality. You recalculate the edge between these measures, and then you would go to one. Yeah. So that's certainly something we have twice, and that's not what we need, okay? Good. So you keep on recalculating the edge betweennesses, removing those that have a high edge between the centrality, and so on and so on. It's clear that what you get is a dendrogram, okay? Because you're continuously removing these edges until you arrive at the singleton cluster. Now, this is a complicated version of a dendrogram that just has more nodes than the toy examples that we had before. Now, the question is, what's the true clustering? Do we cut it here or do we cut it here? Where do we cut it? And I said, okay, the basic idea is that you come up with a cluster validity measure, clustering validity measure, and you would cut at this level where this measure, whatever it is, has the maximum value. And what Newman and Gervin suggested was using modularity. Okay? And what is that? Okay? So, in essence, modularity is nothing but another clustering quality measure. Yeah, nothing more. In this case, it is F-based only, so G is zero, and what it does, it just optimizes intra-cluster coherence. Okay, cool. Let's see. And why am I telling you this? The answer is because that's a really successful method. People keep using it, and the results are very good. So that's one of the most popular current methods that are around. Now, this is the expression for modularity. We can accept that, but we can also try to understand it. Okay. What is modularity? How do we arrive at that? Now, remember, what we want is just F-based, intra-cluster coherence. Good. So, let's assume we have arrived in this situation. Yeah? So that's the graph, and we're having three clusters. Okay. Now we know what we want is that we want to have many edges in there and as few edges across these boundaries as possible, like always. No? Good. So what you do is you take these clusters and count the numbers of edges that go from one cluster to another cluster, and set this into proportion to the total number of edges, okay? And what you get, instead of the original adjacency matrix of the graph, is something that you might call an adjacency matrix between clusters, right? If you have k clusters, you get a k times k symmetric matrix, and each matrix entry just counts the number of edges that go from I to j. Okay, and since we set this into proportion to the total number of edges, this gives us the fraction of edges between the communities. Okay, now, the trace of this matrix is just the fraction of edges that are within the communities. Okay, and that already would be a simple F-type measure, but we already regarded that earlier, but this is not enough. Yeah. So what they suggested to do is to investigate this quantity and compare it to a quantity that would result if we make a random rewiring or a random graph with the same connectivity properties. Okay, so what we want is we say, okay, this is my clustering in my graph, and it has such a value of this intra-cluster edges. Yeah. Now, let's say it's 554.75. What does that tell us? Nothing. Yeah. We must know whether 504.75 is a large value. And in order to know that, what we want is we want to construct a random graph, a random network, but we want to keep the degrees fixed. Yeah. Okay. Good. Now, what's the degree? We said this here, this K times K matrix, is the adjacency matrix of the clusters. Okay. As always, the degree is computed by summing over the column elements for a given row. Yeah. So that's the number of clusters, or the summed up number of edges that this cluster is connected to all the others. Yeah. And in this case, for example, for this cluster, if we sum that, AI would be 1, 2, 3. Yeah. It's connected by 3 edges to all the others. Okay. Now, let's assume we want to do a rewiring. Yeah. So this is our first node. This is our second node. This is our third node. Okay. And we have a certain connectivity in that particular graph and clustering example. Now we want to compute a random version of that where we keep the AIs fixed. Yeah. And in that random network, we also have such an E matrix, and we can have very many variants. Yeah. Like connect this with this 3 times, and these only 1 time, and this only 1 time, and so on and so on. Yeah, lots of random possibilities. And what we want is a statement about what the ijth element of this E matrix for a random network would be. And the intuition tells us that if I do this random network in the following way, okay, so what we have here in this picture is our 3 nodes, right? And what we know is that this one in our real graph has 3 edges that connect this one to others, yeah? So we can already make 3 such stubs, okay? In our true graph, we have 3 edges that connect this one to others, 1, 2, and 3. So we have 3 stops here as well. And 1, 2, 3 stops here as well. Yeah. So these don't need to be equal. Could be that in the original graph, this one, or in the original graph with our current clustering, I should say, this one has 2 and this 4 and so on. Lots of possible variants here. That could be our true situation. Now, if we want to do the random network, what we do is we kind of deal out the weights by choosing pairs of stubs, okay? And then saying, well, I want an edge here, and then I choose these 2 stubs and say, okay, I want it here, and then I choose these 2 stubs, and so on. Yeah, that's the way I can do random graphs. Yeah, but while keeping the degrees fixed, and that's the main point. Yeah, and the probability for 2 stubs that they are used, in a sense, is proportional to the degree AI times AJ. Okay, so the probability, no, not the probability of 2 stubs, but the probability that an edge between this and this occurs is proportional to the number of stops here times the number of stops here. Yeah. If both of them have very many stubs, then it's a high probability that I one time would draw an edge, or even next time I would also draw an edge. Yeah. So this is intuitively clear that this probability, because it's a fraction always, this probability is proportional to AI times AJ. And the IIth matrix element, that's the one we're after, would then be AI squared. Okay. And that's why modularity is the trace of our original E matrix minus the trace of the random networks element. Okay. Now what this does is it compares the connectivity in the original graph, the connectivity within the clusters, to the connectivity within the clusters if I do this randomly. Yeah. And if that difference is high, what does that mean? It means that our original clustering has a high intra-cluster coherence, whereas random clusterings, yeah, and these contain also stubs that are go from one cluster to another, yeah, which then make up the edges in here. If this is high, then and if this is typically low, then we know that it's a good clustering because it has a substantially high intra-cluster coherence. Okay. And much higher than most random graphs constructed with the same connectivity would have. Okay. And that's something we're going to repeat next time, because this is, well, more or less a nice and well working thing. And and then we'll look at weighted versions of that, and then we're done. Okay. So that was that. Now, that's all, and then that's all for the moment with graphs. Yeah. For those of you that hate graphs, next lecture we are not going to deal with graphs anymore, at least not in most cases. What we will do next time is more oriented towards clustering in the sense of data mining. Yeah, so in metric spaces. Yeah. Graphs will then be left out for a second. Unfortunately, for those that hate graphs, we'll return to them, but in another fashion, yeah, with regard to true networks in the real world. Yeah. Okay, that's that. So we'll meet on next Tuesday. Thanks.